Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
I think most people in this world just don't understand how great they are and the power that's behind them. And I say that in the most humble way possible, but most people on this earth are holding their greatness in because either they haven't discovered it or somewhere along the line, someone told them you're not great and they believed it.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by Alicia Jessup. Alicia is a writer for The Athletic and The Washington Post. She's also a professor at Pepperdine University, where she teaches sports law, sports marketing, and sports leadership, and is also a consultant for the NBPA, where she helps NBA players transitioning out of the league and into their future careers. Alicia really gives us some great insight on ways that coaches can help themselves with personal branding on a personal level, how they can identify what their strengths are and create a narrative to help sell themselves. Then we get into a little bit of conversation on social media and ways to use that as a tool to really reflect the values that you want to project. And then finally, we talk about the work she has done with athletes transitioning out of their sports and into their careers. Really a fascinating conversation. And if you're somebody with aspirations to become a head coach or to move up in coaching, or really just need some advice on how to get what you want in life, get out a pen and paper. You're going to want to take notes because Alicia gives us some great, great takeaways here. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Please subscribe, write us a review, and please visit us at risingcoaches.com. Our membership program has now launched. It's available. So if you'd like to become a member of the Rising Coaches Association, you can do so for just $10 a month. We hope you consider joining, and we hope you enjoy the podcast. Alicia, how are you? Thanks for joining us today.
I'm great. Thank you. You actually said my name right. Nobody says it right.
You got to pronounce the I, right? That's part of it.
Yep. Yep.
Well, good. I passed the first test. No, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast because you have been working in sports as a consultant, as a professor, in the media, many different facets around the sports industry and around coaching, but haven't necessarily been caught up in the coaching rat race. So I feel like you can give us some perspective from a different angle with what, you know, coaches struggle with or deal with on a daily basis. So I'm excited to jump in. Yeah.
Yeah, my dad thinks I should coach a kids team for basketball to see if I have it in me.
So what do you think?
The rat race.
Have you tried it out?
I have time. No, I think I would be a really good coach. So if I ever get a little bit more free time, I might go coach a girls like youth team and see what happens.
Yeah, you should. That's awesome. So I guess the first thing I want to ask you about is, you know, as you know, the coaching profession is so, there's so many coaches out there. There's so few jobs. And I think a big part of it and a big struggle on a daily basis for coaches is how do you stand out? How do you separate yourself from the pack? And I want to talk about social media a little bit later, but maybe we can start off, maybe you can give us some perspective on things that coaches can do on a personal level to kind of, you know, like I said, separate from the pack and stand out a little bit.
Right. So with coaching, either you're capable of coaching, you understand how to create plays, you understand how to build a culture, you understand how to motivate players, or you don't. And the problem with the profession, to your point, is there's a limited number of jobs and there's more people that want those jobs. And so if you look at how the industry works, a lot of it is through relationships and networks. So what everybody listening to this podcast probably already knows is you have to be building your relationships and networks. One thing that I don't see a lot of people proactively doing, either because they don't think to do it or they assume that their agents are doing it, is if you look at how the big coaching hires are done, especially in the Division I level, athletic directors and university presidents are making these decisions. And these people aren't necessarily going to the Final Four parties. They're not hitting the ground trying to build a full network of coaches. And so they're relying on companies that do that, which are search firms. And so I think a missed opportunity for every coach and also anybody looking to become an athletics director is proactively engaging with the search firms that operate in that space. And so reaching out to them, creating really captivating either cover letters, emails, or just personal branding stories about who you are and why you should be considered as a candidate. So I think taking a proactive search, not only in networking, not only, some jobs you actually apply to in the coaching space, a lot of them aren't advertised though, but taking a proactive stance of reaching out before a job is even opened could actually benefit a lot of people.
So, all right, throw yourself in like an analogy here. Let's say you're an assistant coach at Pepperdine. You've been doing it for, 7 years, and you've worked your way up. You're a Division I assistant at a, low to mid-major school. You would recommend, shooting off a couple emails or handwritten letters to, maybe some search firms and ADs? And like, what would that look like?
Sure. Yeah. So the one thing just in life in general, whether you want to be a coach, an athletics director, for a person like me whose career is in academia and the media, the last thing you ever want in these highly competitive industries is one of two things. You don't want people to not know who you are or to forget who you are. And so this is where like the personal branding side of things, comes in, is you have to have a story about who you are. And what I recommend to people is you identify like the top three characteristics of who you are as a person and what skills that you uniquely bring to whatever situation you're trying to achieve. So in my life, my top three skills are I'm a really strong writer, I understand sports, and I'm also an attorney. So everything I do from a professional standpoint flows from those three points. For a coach, maybe you are an offensive mastermind, or maybe you know how to create defensive systems like nobody else. Maybe one thing you've done is you have researched and studied how to motivate this rising generation, Generation Z. Maybe you're an incredible recruiter. You need to identify your top three skills, and in a perfect world, your three skills blend together where you use them simultaneously to give yourself an upper hand against the competition. So what you want to do, and this is easier said than done, but you need to create a narrative around those three skills that you possess. So because you possess those three skills, why does it make you better than every other candidate that this school or this team might be considering or that this search firm is engaging with? And so you have to engage in some proactive selling of yourself. And I think coaches, especially at the collegiate level, you're really used to selling yourself because you do it on a pretty frequent basis with recruits. So how can you take the story that you're telling recruits for your respective program or school and use those same skills and turn them inward on yourself? And then create some sort of messaging, whether to your point, it's a handwritten letter, it's a an email, a cover letter, some sort of creative packaging. And yeah, just cold blasting it out to people who actually help drive hiring decisions.
So step one is self-discovery, which can be hard. Any like techniques or, I've heard some different advice in this regard where I was just talking to somebody the other day and they reached out to all of their former bosses and asked them to write down like his 10 best characteristics. And then he compiled that list and narrowed it down to, like you said, three or four. Any other like techniques or practices that can help with that self-discovery practice? Because that's, I think a lot of people probably are floating around not knowing what they're best at.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's very frustrating for me to watch as a professor is I think most people in this world just don't understand how great they are and the power that's behind them. And I say that in the most humble way possible, but most people on this earth are holding their greatness in because either they haven't discovered it or somewhere along the line someone told them you're not great and they believed it. But for me, what the process looked like and this is really earth-shattering stuff here, I got a piece of paper and I folded it in half. And on one side, I just like brain dumped. So I live in California. I went and sat on the ocean. This was around 2011. And on the one side, I just wrote down everything that I'm good at, whether I like to do those things or not. So for instance, I have a pretty strong mathematical mind. I'm pretty good at organizing. I'm a good friend. So it wasn't just like hard skills that I'm good at, but if I'm just letting my brain go and I'm doing a free write on one hand side, here's everything I'm good at. Then on the other side, so you fold the paper in half, what do you like to do? You know, what are the things that if you're waking up on a Saturday or Sunday morning and you have the day to yourself, you don't have any obligations with kids, the spouse, work, whatever it may be, what do you actually like to do? And for me, like how I realized where my strengths were is you find the things that align in both columns and then you start thinking to yourself, okay, so I like sports. I'm good at sports. Those things popped up in both columns. I like writing. I'm good at writing. Those things popped up in both columns. Now, I'm a lawyer. I don't necessarily love being a lawyer, but that's a special skill that other people don't have. So that's my marketable skill. So I think it's just allowing yourself to do some open-minded thinking of what am I good at and do I actually like what I'm good at? You know, if I had to wake up and do this every day for the next 40 years, is that something I would want to do? And if the answer to that question is no, well, then you shouldn't be basing your career brand or your career path on that.
So there's some coaches out there, to put this like in a coaching context, I think there's coaches out there who just love X's and O's. They can sit down, break down video for 24 hours a day, but they hate recruiting. So your advice to them would be, and you know, everyone knows recruiting is a big part of the job, but your advice would be to double down on the X's and O's part. Sell yourself as that offensive or defensive guru, and don't worry about, you know, make your strengths rather than spending your time trying to make your weaknesses stronger. Is that a good summary?
Totally. There's a quote, and I apologize that I don't know who this quote's from, but it goes, you can do anything, but you can't be great at everything. And so what's really worked for me professionally, and again, I'm not a coach and I don't claim to know everything about coaching, but what's worked for me professionally is I've nailed down on a couple of things where everything flows from those couple of things. And then once you understand what those couple of things are, so to your point, maybe it's X's and O's, maybe it's recruiting, where you go with that, once you understand what you have to offer, is you move out into the industry and you see where there's a hole in the industry that your skill or your background was meant to fit. So let's say your skill is X's and O's. What you need to be looking for job-wise and networking-wise are, well, what coaches out there at the head coach or decision-making level don't have that skill the way that I do, and how can I communicate with them, not in an arrogant way, but just tell them, here's who I am, here's my background, here's what I've done, here's the systems I've developed, here's proof of it. Because I've done these things, because I've created these systems, I've driven these outcomes, so here's the positive successes that are backed by what I've done. Because I've driven these positive outcomes in the past, I know I can do it again. And because I can do it again, here's how it would benefit your respective program. So, you know, to your point earlier, it's really hard to get anything in life, whether it is a job, whether it's a relationship, without knowing who you are. And if you don't know the couple of things that make you special and unique, how are you going to sell yourself and make a case that somebody should pick you?
Yeah, it's so funny because like I feel like coaches tell their players this all the time. You know, the classic example is like a three-point specialist. You know, you sign this player, they're a knockdown shooter, and you come into the gym and they're working on their ball handling and finishing all the time. And they get in the game, they try to do something off the bounce, they turn it over, and you look at that player on the bench and you say, you know, why don't you just stick to what you do best? You're a shooter. Just embrace that role And I think people have a hard time turning that on themselves. And I guess probably a lot of it's probably ego, you know, because you feel like you need to do everything well. And maybe some of it isn't. Maybe it's just trying to, you know, fill what you think is the prototypical coach's skill set. But yeah, I think people would be way better served just embracing what they do best.
Yeah, I think it's ego and I think it's pressure. So obviously, especially at the highest levels of coaching, there's a lot on your back and there's this fear and this expectation that if you don't succeed, this entire thing might come crumbling down. But I think to your point, coaches have to remember that just like the players on their roster are part of a team, unless you're coaching at a small high school, you're also part of a team and you have these assistants, you have people below you for a reason. And so how can you effectively delegate roles to those people to bring out the best characteristics of them to get the greatest outcome? So yeah, I think it's taking a little bit of the advice that you give to players themselves.
Yeah, and the pressure also, I think, comes from just this industry. You know, there's so few jobs. There's so many people. There's no, like, direct path of how to get jobs or how to climb up the ladder. You know, like, if you want to be a lawyer, you went to law school, you studied for the bar, you passed the bar. I mean, I'm sure it's a little harder than that, but then you're a lawyer.
Well, okay, so, yeah, I definitely understand that, but I think that's where people get into trouble, is they think, well, there's a limited number of jobs and there's nothing I can do. There's just a limited number of jobs. Well, if that's the way you think, like, yeah, that there's not going to be other jobs, but the people I know or I've seen who have been really successful in coaching, you know, even if you have, I know men who have very powerful coaching lineages, you know, so their grandfathers were some of the best college basketball coaches. They even had to roll up their sleeves and hustle, and like they're bouncing around the country from low-level internship jobs to dobos. So they're grinding too. But the one thing I've seen in coaching and other competitive professions is if you make yourself indispensable, there will always be a job for you. And so from what I've seen in coaching, how you make yourself indispensable is you know the game better than anybody else. Like there's some aspect of the game that you just know better than everybody else. So maybe it's player development. Maybe it is actually building a team culture. Like maybe the head coach just doesn't understand how to build a team culture. Maybe you're an incredible teacher. And what I've learned about life is if you have some skill that is just far and above everybody else's, and if you are willing to outwork other people, there's always going to be a job for you. Like it might not be what you thought it would look like, but if you're great enough, people are going to carve out a space for you on their bench.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Okay, I want to get to something you talked about earlier, you mentioned earlier, which is once you identify that skill, you create a narrative and communicate it with decision makers in a non-arrogant way. And I think that's where a lot of people get caught up is they, okay, even if they do realize what sets them apart, now they feel, you know, just uneasy about talking about themselves. So maybe you can give us some advice on, you know, either ways to get over that or ways to communicate without coming off as a, you know, arrogant or a self-promoter.
Yeah, so I want to go back to the decision maker piece because that's the critical piece that I think a lot of people miss or mess up. So part of my research line deals with advancement in intercollegiate athletics. And so I'm really focused on college athletics directors, particularly women. So like, why don't women rise to the highest level of intercollegiate athletics, which is the director of athletics role? And what I found is part of it is who they're networking with. So the women tend to be networking with women because of where we are in history. Women tend not to be in the highest places of leadership or hold the majority roles in leadership. So if you're only networking with people in positions like you, yes, over time, those people might rise up and they might be able to hire you or bring you on. But for the moment now, they don't have any power to help advance your career. So I think is critical, and that this for a lot of people requires stepping outside of your comfort zone. But on the flip side, I know every coach has a limited amount of time. So you want to be efficient and you want to maximize your opportunity. So you really need to be networking with the people who can make a decision on whether or not to hire you. So either head coaches, athletics directors, a more rare one, this would be pretty aggressive, but I think this doesn't happen a lot. So you might actually get some bites, would be the university presidents. And of course, like we talked about earlier, the search firms. But when it comes to like telling your narrative in a way that's not arrogant or self-promoting, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, knowing those 2 to 3 things that really make you special and stand out. And so how I always begin my story when I'm cold contacting someone is I just say, hello, so-and-so. My name is Alicia Jessup. I'm a California and Colorado licensed attorney who practices in the field of sports law. I've worked in academia for the last X number of years, and I've also worked in sports media for these 3 companies, blah, 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 blah. Paragraph 2. Based on these experiences, these are some skills that I've gained. I'm a strong communicator, I'm a problem solver, and I'm an innovative thinker. Paragraph 3. I've been researching X school or Y program or Z coach, and I've noticed that XYZ school coach or program really excels in these areas. It's been great watching their success recently. One thing I've noticed, though, is it seems that there's an opportunity for them to become even better in XYZ thing. So you're going to call out a thing that you are uniquely positioned to solve. So your final paragraph is explaining to the person, here's how I'm uniquely positioned to solve this problem or to improve this process, whatever it may be, at this respective school. So based upon my experience working as a reporter for these places, I see that you have this communication problem. I know how to solve it. I'd be happy to hop on a call or come to your office to tell you more. So I think the key to eliminating arrogance is everybody wants to hear that they're great. If you come out guns blazing, pointing out all of the flaws and problems in a different program or school, that's going to turn them off pretty quickly. So if you can feed them some compliments, tell them that they're great, but then you're not telling them what they're doing wrong. You're telling them, here's what you could be doing better, and you could really be doing better if you hired me or brought me in as a consultant to address this issue. Because of my unique skills, I'm best positioned to assist you. I don't know if that makes any sense. I feel like I need a whiteboard to map this out.
No, I was following along. That was pretty clear. So along with that, you have to be willing to put yourself out there and almost call out, you know, a situation or call out how you can help. And along with that, you probably have to like be willing to take some rejection or some people ignoring you or whatever. But, you know, if you don't put yourself out there and try, then you can't really complain at the end if those opportunities don't knock on your door.
100%. My friends joke that I am fearless. I am not afraid of rejection at all. And so if there's something that I want, I'm going to use that process I just outlined to go get it. And yeah, like sometimes people tell me no, sometimes people don't respond, but most times people at least open the door to me. I can give you an example. I know we're going to talk about this later, but I've worked in the area of player transition from sport for the last couple of years. And I really want to move into the intercollegiate space consulting on that matter. And so I reached out to one athletics director this summer. You know, I have a full-time job, so I really don't need to be doing this. But I'm like, this sounds like an interesting opportunity. So I used the process I just outlined. I went through that athletics department's website, scrubbed it for anything they're doing to help their college athletes prepare for life after college athletics. Wrote it all down, and they're doing great things, but I was able to see ways that they could improve what they're already doing. So I created a proposal, created a 10-page proposal. There's a possibility that this is a complete waste of time and I never make a dollar off of it. And I use that 5-paragraph email that I just walked you through, attach the proposal, send it to the athletics director. Now we're talking about a Power 5 Division 1 athletics director who probably gets hundreds of emails a day. I get a response in 30 minutes. He says, Alicia, I want to schedule a meeting with you. Awesome. So it's like, it works. It definitely works if you put yourself out there, but it only works if you are explaining to this person, here's the value I can offer you. So there's a difference. I think where a lot of people go wrong is they're asking the other person that they don't know to do something for them. Give me a chance. Give me a job. What you need to do is you need to flip the strategy where you're telling the other person, here's why I'm valuable and here's the opportunity or success I'm going to grow for your program. And so you basically don't give them a choice to tell you no when you approach it that way.
And I would imagine even if you are, you know, admittedly a few years away from that opportunity of being a head coach, there's nothing wrong with reaching out to a search firm and letting them know what your strengths are. This is who I am. And,
yeah,
you know, when the time is right, these are the things I can bring to the table for you.
Yeah, I guarantee you most people are not doing that. And so in these highly competitive industries, yes, there's a lot of competition. But when you really research the candidates in them, there's a handful of people who rise to the top because, one, they have the skills to do the job. But then, two, they're fearless and they're not afraid to put themselves out there in a humble way. To me, something is humility if you can back it up by what you're actually capable of. I think arrogance is blasting off and, you know, just overhyping yourself with things that cannot be backed up. I don't think it's arrogant to let somebody know, these are the unique skills I've been gifted in my life and here's how I can help you with them.
Yeah, and you got to sell yourself because, you know, no one else is going to do that for you. Can sell yourself better than anybody. Let's talk about social media. Obviously, that's a great way to put yourself out there. And, you know, it gives everyone a voice and everyone a platform. You know, are there strategies in that medium that you would encourage or discourage people from using?
So I think it's crazy that I'm even about to say what I'm about to say because social media is no longer an innovative tool. But I think college coaches in particular, and even MBA coaches, are really missing low-hanging fruit in terms of opportunity with social media and the opportunity it presents to brand yourself. So to answer the question most widely, every coach needs a social media presence. And I've talked to a lot of coaches like this, and usually the response I get is, Alicia, I'm not trying to be a member of the media. Okay, like on the face, you're not trying to be a member of the media, but what is the biggest source of revenue for your profession? The biggest source of revenue for your profession is broadcasting rights. So guess what? You might not think you're actively trying to be in the media, but when we really boil down what your job is you're in the media. And so you need to decide how to control your image, how to control the narrative, and also how to create opportunities for yourself by leveraging these free, widely accessible platforms. So on the most basic level, I think every coach needs an open, public social media profile on your major social media platforms. So Twitter, Instagram, a lot of coaches' Instagrams are private. That's a huge missed opportunity. And also Facebook. Then you take the conversation that we had a few minutes ago, because I know the next question is, well, what should I be doing on those platforms? Like, I don't have time to post. You don't. Like, you're a coach. Again, you're not a social media maven or expert. But you can create a content schedule where every couple of days you are posting something that relates back to the 2 to 3 skills that you possess. So this part goes a little bit deeper, where you have to do a lot of intrinsic work and self-evaluation. But like, who are you really as a coach? When a person leaves your program, what do you want them to say? What do you want them to have experienced? What do you want them to have learned, to feel, to know, to be able to do better. So answering those types of questions helps you understand what type of content I need to be showing on my social media accounts to signal that if men or women sign with me and my program, this is what they'll experience. So if you're on the recruiting trail and you're telling mom and dad and the kid, we're a family first program. We're all about family. And I am mom, dad, kid. They're always going to look at your social media. And I go on your social media and there's nothing resembling that. Are you trustworthy in my eyes? And so I think it's just, what are the values of your program? What are you promising in recruiting? How is that being conveyed on your accounts? And how are you also showing to the world and maybe the athletics directors or university presidents who have never met you, but know they're in the hunt for a candidate, and they're just doing some quick social media perusing, how are you letting them know that you're also a capable coach? So I think it's a blend of a few things. If you're on the professional level, obviously you're not speaking to recruits, but I think there's a lot of people that are missing out on additional opportunities, whether it's endorsement deals, whether it's partnerships, whether it's public speaking, because they're not active on social media and letting the world know who they are.
Yeah, and I think like this is where a lot of people might get passed up is, you know, I'm 35. I didn't grow up, you know, like I remember when like the internet came out and like social media came out. And like, so for me to post is something that is like a little bit out of my comfort zone or whatever. I think most people like my age or older, not most people, a lot of people are on social media, but they're on it to consume content, not to put content out there. But like, what did you call them? Generation Z? Like there's like 20, you know, people in Rising Coaches that are 20, 22 that come to our conferences that are just out of college or managers or GAs. And like, this is just what they do. Like social media is part of their life. And like, that's how they communicate with their friends and, you know, just people in general. And I don't know, I feel like they're going to, you know, some people my age that are more passive might get passed up for some jobs because, like you said, they're not putting themselves out there. They're not showing the world what they're doing and what they're about.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts on that. In 2015, I heard a statistic, so it's a little bit old, but 1% of content on Twitter is original content. So that means that 99% of what is posted on Twitter is just retweets. Like how much effort does it take to retweet something? So in the time that you spent going through Twitter, reading other people's thoughts, if you would have put the phone down, people could have thought of their own thought by then and put it out onto social media, where now you're not just a retweeter, you're branding yourself as a thought leader. So you have to think about the young men and women that I'm recruiting, who do they want to play for? Do they want to play for a retweeter or do they want to play for a thought leader? John Wooden, if you look at that man, he does not fit the physical mold of one of the greatest basketball coaches of all time. He was a tiny Caucasian man from Middle America. But what did John Wooden have? He was good at X's and O's, but he was a thought leader. And he was a thought leader where, to the point where even though he's been passed for a number of years, people like me are still teaching their students the pyramids of success. They're talking about the strategies that he utilized, where on the first day of basketball practice, players from Bill Walton to Kareem Abdul are coming into the locker room in Westwood and being taught how to put on their shoes and socks. So I think because of the access to media, it's really easy for us to go down this rabbit hole. I find myself doing this on Instagram some days where you're just looking at what other people are doing. What would happen if you expended that energy instead to create your own content and to become a thought leader? That's how you stand out from the crowd. Most people aren't going to do this. The other thing I would say related to the rising, I mean, you guys are rising coaches, to the rising coaches and the younger generation of people coming up, this is where they're looking. I have a very dear friend who is a top NBA skills agent. He works with one of the best players in the league. And he's like, Alicia, I'm never going to become the biggest person in this profession because my player won't let me film the workouts. And everyone else who is trying to sign someone who does my job wants to go on Instagram and see the workouts filmed. So you have to balance these competing areas of wanting to be seen solely as a coach and wanting to be recognized for your coaching mind versus this world that we're living in, which is a digital world. We're constantly on our phones. Especially if you're at the collegiate level, the people that you're recruiting or coaching do not know life without the internet or a smartphone. So if you aren't there and somebody else is, more than likely you're missing an opportunity.
Yeah, and I think it's also not just like the athletes that you're recruiting, but also, like you mentioned, those people making hires, school presidents, they're on there. They may be in that 99% of people just retweeting, but presidents are on there, ADs are on there, search firms are on there. Yeah, you know, everyone's watching.
Now, I don't think that's where they're going first to make the hire, but they're going to make sure, obviously, that your content is clean. But I can speak for myself. Like, obviously, I think I'm really good at what I do. Do I think I am the best rider? No. Like, there's no way. But if you look at the opportunities I've been given, a lot of it is I put myself out there, and guess what? I wake up every single day of my life, and I create content so people do not forget about me. Like, I am going to stay in your face. I was at a gala in Los Angeles on Sunday, and this guy that I've known for years, like, we're business network associates. I haven't seen him in about 3 years. And he goes, Alicia, every morning I wake up and there's an alert on my phone that you've tweeted because I used to always read your tweets. So I just wanted to let you know you're the first thing on my mind every day because of your tweets. So right. The algorithm really works. And if you're not there, somebody else will be.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, you are an active member of the media, and there's obviously, you know, that relationship between coaches and media, and you know, I think that's another area that makes a lot of coaches uncomfortable, but that's another thing that people could probably use to their advantage if they, you know, have the right relationship and use it wisely. So maybe give us some pointers about ways to deal with the media and ways coaches can use or allow the media to help them.
Yeah, so I think the first thing to recognize is just like a coach has a job, a member of the media has a job to do. And coaches, alongside either their SID or if you're at the NBA level, your vice president of communications, you need to decide internally what your team or company policy is related to you and the media. So what's the thought process for your role with engaging in the media? Where I think a lot of coaches go wrong, and like, don't get me wrong, there are some real jerk beat reporters who are just out there looking for fire. But I think coaches need to understand what journalists are called to do. We are called to be fair, and we are called to be truthful. And we can do our job a lot easier when you cooperate with us. And I understand that sometimes coaches get burned because what they say gets taken out of context, or it gets placed in a story where it just doesn't make sense. And now the coach is looking poorly. And I can understand how that's really frustrating. But I think where a lot of coaches go wrong is they come into the profession or they come into interactions with the media with this perception that the media is the enemy. Back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, you are all in the media business. If your games are streamed, if they're shown on television, you are not just a coach. You are an active participant in media. And so it's thinking about, well, how can I utilize this relationship? I know that there's stories that are going to be told about my team. I know they're going to be published by this journalist. How can I utilize this relationship to improve my personal brand and the brand of my team? And so it really requires a lot of strategy. And what I would encourage every coach to do, if you have access to one, is sit down with your SID, sit down with the vice president of communications. They already should be doing this, but if they aren't, get some really in-depth media training, because you need to be able to synthesize and process the question that's being asked of you and very quickly run through the goals and objectives of you, your team, and your organization and produce a response that promotes those goals and objectives, but also answers the question head on. So that requires a lot of practice, but I think there's a lot that can be done for you professionally by building a strong media presence. I look at Tony Dungy. So this is a football coach. Obviously, Tony Dungy won a Super Bowl, but he was also fired. You know, his career was not safe. It was not clear. But one thing that was unique about Tony is he wasn't just friendly with the media. He was friendly with everyone in the Bucks office. So like he and the, at the time, general counsel of the Bucks became good friends. And so after Tony left and that man was kind of saying, is this really what I want to do? Do I really want to practice law? He reaches out and he's like, hey, let me write a book for you. The man's name's Nathan Whitaker. Let me write a book about your story. And it becomes a New York Times bestseller. And it leads to this spin-off media career for Tony Dungy. So I guess what I'm trying to say is this. Don't look at your career in a vacuum. Because of the digital world, if you want to be successful and have longevity, you are no longer just a basketball coach. You need to understand how to operate, use, frankly, and navigate the media. I look at Kevin McHale. You know, after Kevin got fired from the Rockets, you think Kevin really wanted to go be on television and do play-by-play and in-game commentating? No, he would probably much rather be on the hardwood. But guess what? Like, since he's on those broadcasts, he's at the forefront of people's minds, where if an opportunity comes up, he's not someone who's just been sent out to the farm to rest, but people are like, oh yeah, that guy was a good coach.
Yeah, and I feel like the guy that comes to mind for me that's really good at this and is constantly putting out content and messaging without, in my opinion, coming off as a self-promoter is Buzz Williams. And he's very authentic in what he does. And I don't even think he publicizes this anymore, but when he was at Marquette, first of all, the first thing one of his staff positions is like a photographer and content producer. So I think that's a little unique. Mm-hmm. And she was great. And she would come to every team function, take pictures and help, you know, with that social media content. But one thing that he does that he feels strongly about, you know, he has a nonprofit called Buzz's Bunch. And I know he did this at Marquette. I think they still do it. And it's for, you know, kids with disabilities, and they come to the pregame shoot arounds for home games, hang out with the team, shoot around with the players. And obviously that's something he's passionate about, and he's not doing that for publicity. But if you are doing something like that, you know, there is a photographer there documenting it, and it is great stuff that people like to hear about and makes people feel good. And, you know, I think that's a way to get great, you know, goodwill in your community. And it's also, like, more importantly, helping a good cause. And that's something that can be done whether you're at Marquette or whether you're at, you know, like the high school down the road.
Yeah, yeah. And it's 100%. And again, the other thing, I know this isn't in our script, but the other thing I think rising coaches really need to spend some time on is reading about this rising generation, Generation Z. So what are their preferences? What motivates them to buy into something? And one thing we're learning about this generation is increasingly they're saying two things. One, we want to feel like we're part of something bigger than ourselves. And two, we want to support brands that give back. So there with Buzz, Buzz is giving back to the community. As a coach, what could you do to give back to your community? So perhaps instead of going the normal route where you have these summer camps where kids spend hundreds to thousands of dollars, you make the biggest bulk of your income through these summer camps. Could you also go into an underprivileged community and host a similar camp, not just because you're looking for outcomes for yourself, but because you genuinely care about this group of people? And what dividends could be driven through that? So I think that's a really interesting point, but it also provides some homework for those listening is, what are you reading? Are you reading psychology? Are you reading sociology? How are you learning about the habits of this group of young men and women that someday you are going to be leading? The other thing I wanted to say is, if you're worried about sounding like a self-promoter or arrogant on social media, one word that you can eliminate to make sure you aren't doing that is the word I. And so you really have to change your frame of mind from saying, okay, my social media posts are going to position me as a thought leader. Well, to become a thought leader, you have to eliminate first and second person from your sentences. So if you strip the sentence of the word I, and often even the word we, because then you're just promoting your team, which at the end of the day is you, but instead say something eliminating those words, it becomes more of a thought. And so you're just pushing thoughts out instead of self-promotion.
Yeah, that's a great takeaway. Okay, I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about your experience with the NBA Players Association, because this is probably the most important stuff. We've talked about, you know, we spent the first 40 minutes talking about how coaches can better themselves and improve their brand and set themselves apart. But you do a lot of work with the Players Association and on like how coaches can help their athletes succeed after their playing careers. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your work there and some things that coaches can be doing to ensure success for their athletes after they're done playing.
Right. So there's a growing trend in professional and now even intercollegiate sport of what's called athlete transition. So preparing athletes for life after the game. We don't call it retirement because we don't believe an athlete ever really retires. They just transition into a new stage of life. So in 2018, I was lucky enough to work with former NBA player Antonio Davis to help build the first program for NBA players transitioning out of the league. So it's called the Off the Court program. And what we did is we built a research instrument to survey the players to understand what their needs were related to transitioning. But we also went and identified standards of best practice in other places in sports. So what's the NCAA doing? What's the NFL doing? USOC, MLB, et cetera. And it's a really interesting space because it's an emerging research field. It's an also emerging program that's coming across all of your professional and intercollegiate sports. But at the end of the day, most men and women are vastly underprepared for their athletic career to end. And a big reason for this is so many of these men and women's entire identity is built into their present as an athlete. And oftentimes you have to fully immerse yourself into the identity of an athlete to become a high-level athlete. So that's not surprising. But one thing coaches could be doing that's really simple, and a lot of coaches are going to be unwilling to do this because of what I just said, but spending time individually with your players and learning who they are off of the court. So what do you like to do? Who do you spend time with? What's something that you really like about yourself that's not basketball? So the USOC does this program for former Olympians, and they told me something that I think is an interesting exercise for everyone. One thing they do is they get like a spool of rope, and they put enough rope on there where what you do as the athlete is you're standing and you're unspooling the rope, and there's enough rope on there for you to unspool it for about 2 minutes. And what the athlete has to do while they're unspooling this rope is they have to talk about who they are, but never once in that 2 minute period can they talk about who they are as an athlete. So if they mention, oh, and I won a gold medal, or I broke the world record in this, or I used to practice every day at 5 a.m., you have to start the spool over again and go. And I think this is a really interesting exercise, not just for athletes, but those of us in competitive industries too, because when I think about it, I'm like, okay, Alicia, like, who are you if you lose your academic career, if you lose your media career, and you lose your law license? Like, who is Alicia Jessup but for those three things? So I think that's one thing coaches can be cognizant of, is building up these young men and women to recognize, yes, you are an incredibly gifted athlete, and we are very grateful for that. But you are also a brother. What does it mean that you're a brother? What kind of brother are you? You're a son. What does it mean that you're a son? You're a friend. You're smart. You're funny. You're creative. We need to start telling people that they're more than a basketball player.
Yeah, I love that. And again, that's great stuff that actually like helps the people that you're serving on a daily basis. Alicia, thank you so much for taking the time and giving us some insight from a different angle. It's been really enlightening. Where can people follow along with what you're doing, and maybe tell us a little bit about your site, rulingsports.com, as well?
Yeah. So my poor site is very, very abandoned because I'm writing for The Athletic now, so I don't have time there. So hopefully you read The Athletic. We have really great content there. So I cover sport business there. My Twitter is ruling, so like ruling sports with an S, and I'm also on Instagram under the same handle. Just don't send me creepy DMs.
All right. Thank you so much, Alicia. Again, we really appreciate it, and thanks for all your insight.
Awesome. Thank you so much.